Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. Let's turn the microphone over to Duff McKagan for the joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you. Listen, man, our dog got out last night, so I went to the park and looked for 20 minutes. Couldn't find it. I came home. My wife said, didn't look hard enough. So I shaved my head, got some tattoos. Still couldn't find the dog. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
I think we might have heard that one before or something similar, but it's okay. I mean, Duff's been doing this for over 3 years. If he has a couple repeats, I don't mind. Thanks to Duff for calling every single week. It wouldn't be a Friday here on Talk is Jericho without a joke of the week, that's for sure. And it wouldn't be a Thursday if it wasn't for the Winnipeggers. Come laugh with me and Dave Spivak and Ribo every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern on my YouTube channel and Facebook page. This week, it's all about high school yearbook write-ups. You guys have those here in the States where you give your most embarrassing moment, most cherished moment, your fate, your goals. It's actually pretty funny. So come join the Peggers and see pictures of us when we were in high school now on Facebook and YouTube. And no Saturday special this weekend. There's lots of things going on. As now that the kids are back in school, there's a lot more activities on a Saturday night. So don't fret. We're still going to do the Saturday Night Special whenever I can. This weekend, there will not be one. People always yell at me when there isn't a Saturday Night Special. Why didn't you say anything? Well, I'm saying something right now. So no SNS, but I'll let you know what I can do the next one very soon. But what I can do is continue to release Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday, like clockwork. And returning to the show this week, my longtime friend and Talk is Jericho alumni, Eli Roth. I think this is probably his, fifth or sixth appearance on the show. But this time, we're welcoming another great American filmmaker, Mark Borchardt. He's the man who created the horror short film classic Coven, also the subject of the 1999 film American Movie, which documented the 3 years that Mark spent writing, shooting, and editing Coven. Or is it Coven? That's something they debate in the movie. He's working on a sequel to that film, and he's working on a bunch of other stuff as well. He's a very creative, quirky guy, as is Eli, as is myself. So he and Eli talk about their creative process, and we all talk about some of our favorite movies and directors. It's a great discussion about the art of filmmaking. Right here on Talk is Jericho. So the cool thing about kind of everyone being under stay-at-home orders is that there's a lot of chance to talk to some old friends, make some new ones. So Eli Roth has been on Talk is Jericho many times before, but we also have a mutual appreciation for filmmaker and film expert Mark Borchardt. So this is actually the first time, besides a brief conversation that you and I, Mark, had the day that the three of us are meeting each other.
Yes, and there's no expert to it. You just know what you know, and that's about it.
And, you know, Mark, actually, I don't know if you remember, we spoke when I was making Cabin Fever back in, this was October of 2001 or September. I actually tracked you down and asked you to play a part in the movie. And you were so sweet about it. You were like, oh, I can't because I just did the one with Jet Li and I'm a must join for SAG. And it was going to complicate production issues on Northwestern. So you were unable to do it, but you were very, very nice about it. And then I wound up telling Ty West that. And then you wound up working with him in the sequel in Ty's Cabin Fever 2, which I thought was a very cool connection.
Yeah, it's all amazing. I mean, you obviously have a very good memory. And I'm very thankful for all of that. It's very cool, and time goes by fast, and here we are. It's actually 2020 now. But Eli, you know, thanks for inviting me for Cabin Fever, though. That was nice of you to ask, definitely.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I know we don't want to go too far into the past, and we'll keep it to the present, because there's a lot of stuff. I've been following your Twitter, and I just love all the kind of inspirational stuff that you put out there. But I really felt a kindred spirit when I did see the documentary, and I felt like, man, this is someone I had a parallel childhood. The way you described seeing Dawn of the Dead for the first time that we didn't know was, you know, independent or low budget or what was 16 millimeter. We just knew that there was something different. And when you rented a movie like Demons, I was like, I don't understand why this doesn't feel. Now we know it's an Italian movie that was dubbed in English and shot in Italy with European actors redubbed. But at the time, those movies felt like they had no rules and you could just go crazy. And it was just such a much more exciting way, you know, kind of cinema. And I feel like you've really kind of kept to your own aesthetic over the years and what you've pursued and what you've filmed. But I always felt this kindred spirit with you, even before we spoke.
Well, first of all, like with the Romero situation is that, you know, obviously that he was part of a commercial house back in Pittsburgh, and they were perpetually challenged to create these low budget commercials, and their imaginative prowess was continually had to be invoked. And then that sense of that sensibility of being effective with what you had kind of transmuted. Like when he shot his film in the mall, there was a sense of spatiality, there was a sense of mastery of the editing concept with rhythm and time, that kind of you actually felt its presence, that this was someone learned in the craft of editing and composition. So with that film, it stood out as with the immediate presence of someone who was actually a craftsmanship in the field of cinema itself via these commercials being shot by him in Pittsburgh.
But also horror movies, you know, were so even if it's low budget, you don't care if the scare is good. And when I watch, you know, you think about the Super 8, you know, the more the scarier, the Super 8 movies, like we could literally line up Psycho, Station Wagon, Leatherface versus Kitty Carryall, like some of the splatter on the linoleum, like my Super 8 movies, you could switch them. And I guarantee you, other than the location, they would be indistinguishable. It's like we were both trying to do the same thing at the same time.
Well, let me throw my hat in there, too. We did them all the time as well. And the series that we had was Don't Go to Uncle Earl's Cabin for the Weekend. And the killer was the bag man. Why? Because there's nothing else we could find to put over the guy's head. So we just literally took a paper bag, cut the eyes out, and he became the bag man. But it's all
a killer.
It all starts the same way when you're a kid with the advent of video cameras. Now suddenly everyone can make a movie when you're 13, 14, 15 years old.
Well, you know, Chris, you bring up something interesting because, you know, with us, Mark, I imagine you were the same one, like having a Super 8 camera and using it to make movies. It was kind of a rare thing to do that. But now everybody has cameras, obviously. And, you know, Mark, I find, you know, you've been able to take your whole world in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, and you give it this kind of, you see it through this almost like an Ingmar Bergman like filter, that you see everything in this kind of poetic, interesting way that some people see their towns or where they live as dreary or drab. And you really have seen kind of the beauty in gray skies and all of these things. And I think
you almost talked to the wrong guy. And actually, I'm from Milwaukee, so that you're kind of playing into an illusion. Actually, all of that stuff that you're referring to, I'm actually from Milwaukee and live in Milwaukee, and that was all filmed in Milwaukee. So you have to look at that as kind of like some misaligned data for reasons. So it's actually in real life, in the real world, this is all occurring in Milwaukee, even to the point as we speak in this moment.
But I love the way you kind of see things, and all of the things are about, you know, you're kind of finding your creativity in writing. And what I just been curious sort of how you've been, everyone's kind of going through obviously a different experience with the quarantine, but I sort of, there's so many different avenues we can talk about. I'm just curious about how it's affected your creative process, what you're making at the time, and sort of how you're able to tune out distractions and kind of create.
Well, first of all, there is no effect whatsoever. I would estimate it would take about at least a year for me to realize that something's potentially amiss and maybe want to go to a film or a restaurant. There's some people that have revealed that if it does, I mean, obviously it will go back to normal, but if it wouldn't, they'd be fine either way. And I've got enough to do. I'm a rich interior life, both figuratively and literally. And I'm already 30 years behind. So if they said, hey, you got to stay in the crib for a year, I wouldn't blink an eye. It wouldn't matter to me. And I don't understand the isolating part of it, because I'm in a city of 1.5 million people in the lake community. I'm looking at people right now safely exercising. So it doesn't, there's no effect for someone like me, because every minute a new thought, the mind regenerates itself. So it's like, whoa, I'm alive, you know, and there's all these options. And I, like I said, I'm 30 years behind. I've got so many screenplays, so much editing, so much music, so much things to do that there's no effect that potentially other people who are going nuts may be feeling. It's not happening over here.
Chris, do you ever feel that? Because Mark, what you're describing, the feeling of being 30 years behind, I feel that, weirdly, I feel that as well. I feel like, I once read a quote from Terry Gilliam that he said, he's just depressed that he's going to die before he can make all the movies that are in his head. And I feel like there's this constant scramble of just, I have to write it all down before, you know, I'm out of here. I don't know, Chris, because you're always doing so much with your, you know, the cruise tours and the wrestling and the books you write. Do you feel like, and the music, you're like, I have to do everything before I die, or I'm already behind?
I think it's one of those things, like when I was a kid, you know, it's the typical story that I always say. I wanted to be in a rock and roll band and I wanted to be a wrestler. So once I was able to accomplish those, then any other project that I felt, you know, worthy of trying, I could pretty much make it happen to a certain extent. So I have a lot of stuff going on, but I'm also a completist. Like once I start something, I have to finish it or at least get it rolling until I can move on to the next. So it's a little bit different in that there's no boundaries on me on what I want to do creatively. But when I start one thing, I really try and finish it or at least set it a sail, you know, to get the voyage going before I can go to the next. I get the feeling, Mark, that you have a lot of things going on at the same time, that you're spinning a lot of different plates.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also, because life is serious and life is precious, there's no anxiety to get anything done. There's no sense of failed romanticism or anything like that, or any illusions created like that. It's done at a reasonable, healthy pace. And there's no like, oh, I wish I would have done that or that. Because today is actually your day to do that. And since I'm already on the case, I'm already in the game, I can die without anxiety. In fact, as we speak, I have to make notes for the rest of the day to make sure that, you know, things get done. So that's where that stands.
All right, Eli, what do you want to ask Mark?
Well, there's two things that I want to ask. One is, certainly a lot of people have been asking me for movie recommendations in the quarantine. And I know that Mark really has an encyclopedic knowledge of some more obscure movies. And I feel like when, you know, people like Mark or myself that really can go like deep on movies, or you, Chris, you have to almost be a sommelier and sort of guide people. You don't want to start them at the most weird, esoteric, advanced one. But I saw on Twitter, Mark, you know, Sean Baker had posted the Blu-ray of Putney Swope for that he got right. Vinegar Syndrome. And I was like, I forgot about Putney Swope. I didn't know there was a 4K scan. And I ordered a whole bunch of Blu-rays from them. But that's such an example of a movie that is so like ahead of its time and contemporary. I was curious if you've been doing any lists or recommendations or, you know, what stuff, if you had any favorite picks that, or what you've been watching this quarantine.
Well, first of all, I'm not going to recommend really anything to anyone because I'm not going to impose my taste on someone else. And then there's also kind of like echelons of, you know, from the primitive to the academic person. So, but anyway, when you mentioned Putney Swope, it's like, well, don't, I mean, just to be obvious, don't forget like Brian De Palma pre-Theory days, he was actually on the, really at the apex of American experimental narrative filmmaking, which included Hi Mom and Greetings, which is not unlike Putney Swope in a sense and tone. You can go back to Frankenheimer's Seconds. And if you haven't seen that, what a marvelous film. And this again is in the realm of even ending with like Dennis Hopper's last movie, like in 71 yeah. or whatever. When you say Putney Swope, it's kind of like in the middle of that mid 60s or early 70s era, like a William Greaves's Symbiote Psychotaxiplasm.
That was the movie. Yeah. You mentioned that yeah. movie and I hadn't seen that. I heard you talking about it on the Movie Geeks. That sounded really like that. It's just like a whole other treasure trove of movies. First, De Palma, that early De Palma, Hi Mom is probably, you know, one of my favorite, if not my favorite, next to Scarface, De Palma movie. I think Hi Mom is a masterpiece. Hmm. There's an Arrow put out a great remastered Blu-ray of A Wedding, Greetings, and Hi Mom. But it does have that same, you know, especially with the Be Black Baby stuff, the
yeah,
Radicals.
There
it's
you
the
go.
Same charged. It's like Putney Swope 68. Also, Bogdanovich's Targets, I watched yeah. recently. I was putting that in that, you know, political movies kind of in with a thriller buried inside of it, as Quentin says. But there's such an interesting period of those, you know, kind of those new filmmakers with Seconds and Targets and Hi Mom and Putney Swope.
And David Holtzman's Diary as well.
Oh, okay. That's another one.
Have you seen that?
No, I've never.
That's one to see. Yeah, David Halsman's diary is actually one of the premier evidences of that era.
Hmm.
Awesome. And so
David Halsman's diary.
Psychoplasmic. Can you repeat that?
It's symbiopsychotaxoplasm take one.
Take one, man.
What you could do is you could break it into its four component parts, symbiopsychotaxoplasm, and then take one.
And I want everybody to learn how to spell that. There will be a quiz later.
That's good. But I love it. Well, that's the great thing about cinema is that you think, not that you think you've seen everything, but that there's some masterpiece that's out there that's waiting to be discovered. You know, I've been sort of watching a lot of the early French, kind of 80s French New Wave. Like, did you ever see Diva, the Jean-Jacques Beignet film from 1981?
I think I've seen that several times for one. And I think I actually got to see it up on the big screen at least once. But no, Diva I've seen several times.
Yeah, I love Diva. Diva to me feels like the start of modern cinema, like the Tarantino, Luc Besson, even David Lynch, so many Tony Scott, so many filmmakers, you know, and then also the kind of the 90s stuff, the Delicatessen, Jhené Caro. I've been watching that lately. George C. Scott and Hardcore. I rewatched
Schrader.
And then I kind of went from Hardcore after I watched Targets. I went into Star 80, which I'd seen as a kid and I hadn't rewatched.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen that, Chris? Yes. The amazing performance of Eric Roberts. It's really incredible.
Yeah, I remember when that came out. I saw it it was one of the first movies I ever rented on VHS because...
That Warner VHS, I remember it.
Yeah, because of Mariel Hemingway, and there was you know, a promise of seeing some bare breasts, which when you were 13 years old, that was what all you cared about back then was trying to rent movies where you could see some tits.
Exactly. Well, I rewatched it, and it was really... There's a documentary about Peter Bogdanovich called One Day Since Yesterday, all about that whole situation where he made They All Laughed with Colleen Camp and Audrey Hepburn and Ben Gazzara. And he made it with Dorothy Stratton. And then, you know, her husband killed her with a shotgun and he had to edit the movie and he kind of lost his mind. And so I watched the documentary is really, really terrific. But then I rewatched Star 80 after I hadn't seen it. And it's one of the like, Eric Roberts, you realize just how great he was. It's really a really interesting movie.
Let me ask you guys a question. I mean, both you guys are such deep, deep, very knowledgeable on movies. And I have certain areas that I'm into. Eli knows my horror knowledge and that sort of thing. But what was it that got you guys so into the movies? Can you remember being kids? Like, what was your first few movies that you saw that really made you think about the direction and the cinematography and that sort of thing?
Mark, do you want to go?
Well, the silence of who goes first.
That's right. Exactly.
I can start. I mean, I remember vividly, you know, it's weird. I have these benchmark memories. Like, I remember being terrified and fascinated by the flying monkeys in Wizard of Oz when I was three. I remember going to see Star Wars when I was six, just thinking that that was a real planet that existed. Like, I didn't. That was the movie that made me just, I'd never been so excited about anything, let alone movies. And then when I was eight, I went to see Alien. And that was the first time I was conscious of what a director does. And I remember asking my dad, like, what does the producer do? I think I want to be a producer. He said, Eli, the producer finds the money. And then I said, what does the director do? He said, well, the director spends the money. I was like, I think I want to be a director. And then I remember seeing the credits for, like, I was like 11, like 2001 and Clockwork Orange. And it said produced and directed by Stanley Kubrick. And like at your bar mitzvah, when you're 12 or 13, you have to tell the rabbi what you're going to do with your life, as if you know. But weirdly, I did. And I said, I want to be a producer director. And he said, well, do you want to be a producer or a director? I said, both. Because that's the only way to retain control of your cut. I was like, and he just looked at me like I was like an alien. I mean, this was, you know, the mid 80s, but there, I really had this awareness of, oh yeah, you could. And I think it was Evil Dead was the movie that made it accessible for me. Reading Fangoria, when that issue came out, and I was like 12 or 13, it said that Sam Raimi was 20 or 21 when he made the movie. I thought, oh my God, you can, that's not so far away. You can be 21 and make a movie and it can wind up in Fangoria. Like that could actually happen. It could be in a video store. That concept, when I was 13 or 14, really kind of gelled in my brain. That's the path I have to take.
What about you, Mark?
Yeah, I was just studying books and I was looking at very dramatic black and white film stills, and it was very fascinating. So I got into film just through reading, looking at the dramatic imagery of all of these films like Bergman and so on and so forth. So I just started to, when I finally got a Super 8 camera back to focus, made sure that it was extremely in focus, that the compositions were symmetrically aligned, and that the editing was down to the frame. And that's how I got into it again, more through a academic avenue in a sense. But yeah, so I wasn't like in front of the TV. I wasn't doing this or doing that. It was more interior. And it was also kind of like symbiotically aligned with the outside world, looking at the trees, looking at the homes and all of that stuff, and finding aesthetic inspiration in that.
Mark, do you remember shooting stuff on Super 8 and then you'd have to like mail it or drop it to a lab and then come back 2 weeks later? And that was like the most nerve wracking time, praying your stuff was in focus. Do you remember that?
Well, of course I remember that, because I bought the film at Kmart, dropped the film off at Kmart. And I understand what Eli's talking about, if, you know, there'd be scratches or if they completely mess it up or so on and so forth. Fortunately, I never, ever in Super 8 or 16 millimeter had that. I was very fortunate that didn't happen, and it was always so magical to put that film in the projector and see something that you had filmed come to life. It's truly magical.
The very first movie I can remember seeing was a movie by Stanley Donen called The Little Prince. You guys know this movie? It's starring...
No, I don't know.
It's starring Gene Wilder, and dude, it's one of the weirdest movies ever, and I watched it back a few years ago, and it's very French, kind of avant-garde, about a kid in the desert who disappears, and Gene Wilder plays a giant fox and all this sort of stuff. And for some reason, my parents took me to it, because I guess they thought Little Prince, and I was a little kid, but I still specifically remember seeing that movie in the theater, and it's amazing. This is 1974. It's amazing how those movie moments can be retained in your mind for your entire life.
It's also those things like the certain music or movies, like that's sort of that's where your aesthetic is formed. If it catches you at a certain age, a certain movie at a certain time. And like, it's weird. It's the way you talk, the way you dress. They had that power. I mean, Mark, do you find inspiration in anything today, or do you find yourself kind of going back to the classics, or do you go to literature?
Okay. All good. And we'll be all answered. First of all, I want to clarify that Kmart was on 76th and Good Hope on the northwest side of Milwaukee. So those listening in Milwaukee will be saying like, damn, cool. Now,
amazing.
As an inspiration, I read over 100 books at a time. I've got thousands and thousands and thousands of books. I calculated that if we have to be inside the crib, I could do 300 years because I got enough material. I sat and did the calculations. So in reading, of course, is great aesthetic inspiration. Films in the here and now, of course. I mean, I could go on and on, you know, Greta Gerwig's work, Noah Baumbach's work. I mean, just et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's like bypassing like Philip Carell, bypassing all the people that I can't even think about right now that are just having all of these wonderful contemporary authors. Film's been around publicly since the mid-1890s. So that's over 120 years of treasure. So yeah, I dig contemporary film. Definitely, when it's kind of like real, a lot of those films, sophisticated films, with its adherence to the symmetrical instinct, making very clean, airy lines and stuff like that. Definitely. And there's inspiration all over. But it's not a matter of consumerism. Again, it's an act of symbiosis. It's an act of nourishing oneself, whether it's from other aesthetic forms or life itself or your own interior manifestations. It all comes together, man, and you keep rolling.
Mark, are you a fan of the film Killer of Sheep by Charles Burnett?
First of all, I had the opportunity to see that on the big screen on 16. Yeah, late 70s watch. I was born up into that. I went to the university, and we had years of experimental film crammed down our throat. I'm not talking about Burnett's offering. I'm talking about all of the package, Dare,
and package, Maya, Dare.
Yeah, all on 16 millimeter, just nonstop year after year.
It's something. I remember when I, in film school, you know, you're like, you grow up with Star Wars and the 80s movies, and then they show you Meshes in the Afternoon and Chien Andalou. And at the time, a lot of that stuff was unreleased. So you're only watching it in a theater and La Talante, and you just come out of these things and your whole, your whole framework, your whole, it's like your whole compass has been reset.
Yeah. It's a, in all those three films that you mentioned, and the last one by, Jean de Gaulle, you know, that's the only feature that he made. And in some circles, you know, they always do, oh, the greatest film ever made, just pure mythology. But that, when you say, when you mention that film, that's what it reminds me of. You know, it's one feature and it's like the great film. But anyway, yes.
Eli, when you go to film school, what exactly do you do at film school? Like, what are they teaching you?
Well, I mean, when I was there, you know, freshman year was Super 8. I mean, that has obviously changed now. But they told us that you get your hands on the cameras the first year. So, so like half the year it's film or like it was film and photography for year one. Then you start getting into 16 millimeter year two. So you were kind of making your mistakes on, you know, photography and Super 8, learning about composition. Some of it's theory. Your English class becomes screenwriting. You have to take like different, you know, there's like the general introduction film classes where you're there showing you Rules of the Game and Rear Window and really teaching you about auteur theory and sort of critical film analysis. Then as you get older, you can specialize. Like some kids are cinematography nerds. They want to go deep into the camera classes. Whereas I went into, someone told me that they're like Martin Brest's and Scorsese's acting teacher. She was this incredible, incredible teacher. And they said, you can't leave without taking her class. Marquetta Kimbrell. She was about 70 years old, but she was like a teenager. And it was like, it changed everything. Like my whole point of view of how to direct from an actor's perspective. Because you know, you act in your movies. So, you know, it's a completely different skill set from going where you're kind of technically framing the camera in a shot to when you're giving a performance. But that was, so by the time you graduate, you sort of find what you like. But it's 4 years. You just, I loved it. Some people think it's a waste of money, but I think I was very, look, I'm an immature person in my 40s now. So as a teenager, I needed to grow up and it was a good place for me to kind of safely make mistakes. That's what I'll say about it.
Yeah. And for someone to say that it's a waste of money is crazy as hell. I went to the University of Milwaukee, and that was actually, that film program began in the mid 70s. And those guys, they knew the experimental filmmakers in that. And I'm autodidactic, so I'm not going to say that, I learned stuff, obviously, in film school. I paid attention to the point where one of the professors, when he booked off to work to L.A., turned to me and said, you want to teach this class? And I said, yeah, you know, hell yeah. I mean, I'll get paid to do this. And, you know, showing the equipment, this, that, the other thing, because I was down with it. I was into it. And those teachers and professors were very attenuated to the world of film and aware of the transactional, or that, hey, you know, you're responsible for doing all of this stuff. I'm going to keep an eye on you and all of that. And, you know, some of us just thrived in it. But I'm not going to say like, oh, I learned it in school. No, I learned it on my own. And it was complemented by the academic world. But then at the same time, I was doing all my own stuff too, doing my own writing, scripts, storyboards, whatever had to be done. So it was just like there was a parallel universe going in film school, what they were doing and what you were doing. So it was a good atmosphere for sure.
And Chris, what Mark says is exactly what I did. Of film school is half the equation. You know, I was interning, I was working on movie sets, I was writing my own scripts. But by the time I graduated, I had a job because I was running a producer's office and reading. So I was on the set. I worked on Quiz Show as assistant to the producer. This movie Naked in New York. Like, I graduated school with movie credits, and I would work on them for free just to get experience. So, you know, I think that a lot of people kind of live in the film school bubble. But the only way to really, you know, learn, you gotta get out there and do your own thing. And I think that you've really had such an interesting career and kind of kept it so personal. Was there a moment where you felt a pull, like, I want to go and do kind of Los Angeles or New York and do sort of more different types of, you know, kind of more Hollywood, quote unquote, movies? Or were you always just like, I love what I'm doing, I want to keep expressing myself and just keep pushing my creativity? I'm just curious why you sort of chose the path where you were?
Oh, first of all, it's because of who I am. First of all, I've been Los Angeles, New York, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Films, Hollywood, acting, directing, whatever. So it doesn't, it's not like abstract to me. It's a very empirical thing. It's hands on. I've done it, and it has nothing to do with my filmmaking. Filmmaking to me is a very sensual, intellectual, ambient form of persuasive living and persuasive work, which has nothing to do with making films in that other world whatsoever. It doesn't register to me to do something like that. I have a responsibility here in Milwaukee. I have a responsibility here in Wisconsin to do my life's work, which has nothing to do with that kind of stuff. My films are these personal tracks of thought and curiosity. So there you have it.
That's interesting, Eli. Now, how does that relate to you? Because you have to walk the fine line as a big budget Hollywood, very successful director, A-list films, et cetera, et cetera. How do you do those big money films, but still keep them as personal as you possibly can, the way that Mark just described?
You know, it's really interesting what Mark sounds like. Apparently Quentin was on a podcast recently talking about how Martin Scorsese was offered Escape from Devil's Island, and Cassavetes talked him out of it and said, make personal movies. And then Scorsese went and did Mean Streets because Cassavetes was like, you got to do personal films. That was like I thought that I was going to do that. I thought Cabin Fever and Hostel in my mind they were both movies that were done. It was $1.5 million and then just under $4 million, you know, kind of outside the system with independent financing. And I thought, you know what? At the time, if I could get these on DVD, they'll make their money back. Mm. And that was always the goal, was to make the money back. But, you know, because they were horror films and there was a big audience for it, it led to other things. But I sort of kept off, you know, even Green Inferno or Knock Knock, I sort of wanted to keep making. The first five movies I did were sort of weird personal movies that I wrote. They wound up sort of being in more of a mainstream because I could couch them in a genre. They weren't like Sundance dramas, those kinds of things. But then when I did Death Wish, it was sort of me wanting to try doing a studio movie. And same thing with House of the Clock in its Wall. So the irony is that even though I'm visible because of sort of having been in Inglourious Basterds and done other stuff, in my mind, kind of those first five movies or even Man with the Iron Fist writing, they were very, even though they were straight down the middle genre movies, I was trying to do my personal version of it so that when I got to do a studio movie like House of the Clock in its Walls, and I come up with a bunch of weird ideas like vomiting pumpkins or automaton attacks, I can do kind of personal ideas with like a nice budget behind it. I guess that was, but you sort of make personal, I would make movies, personal movies until I go broke. And then I was like, all right, I need a job. Let me do a studio right. movie so I can make money. So I could then, you know, you just kind of do it until you go run out of money and then you do another one.
Talk about a director that all three of us have some respect for, lots of respect for, in Werner Herzog. And I know I've heard you talk about Werner before, Mark, and you as well, Eli, because that's a director kind of who's always been kind of underneath the wire, so to speak. People who know films know him, but he's never really had the blockbuster super huge hit.
Yeah.
Well, I mean. He does his own personal films. Even Dwarf started small. Strozik, Heart of Glass, Nosferatu. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I don't think there's a matter of having a hit or this or that. He's like an inspiration doing his thing. His films are wonderful environments of human eccentricity in you know, the wide landscape of possibility. And so I think he lives in his own region, man. And it's just great stuff.
He's amazing. I mean, I remember when I was, and again, it's where film school and, you know, having a professor that's a really good, again, like a DJ or a sommelier, someone that can kind of help open your mind up by showing you the right movies at the right time. They showed us Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo. Mm. And when you you think you're going to class and you know you're going to see something interesting, and they go, okay, we're going to watch this German movie. It's about the knights, and they're in the jungle, and they're trying to convert people, and they're the Crusades, and you're okay, and you're just riveted from frame one. And you know what makes it so powerful is you know that they're there, and you know that you can't act that, you can't pretend that they're moving. When you see them moving a boat over a mountain, they're actually doing it. And there's a part of you that just can't believe, because film equipment is cumbersome enough, as Mark will tell you, as we all know.
Right.
Imagine moving a boat along with it. So you start going, who is this guy? And then he's doing the incident at Loch Ness. Is, you know, like his filmography is so wild and diverse that it's like becomes like Takashi Miike or one of these guys that you're just in awe of their creative output. And indefatigable is the word that comes to mind. But those are Aguirre and Fitzcarraldo was what made me want to make Green Inferno as much as Cannibal Holocaust did. I was like, I need to have that experience of going in the jungle with a film crew and fighting the elements and seeing what comes out of it. But Herzog, then you see him on, have you guys been watching him on The Mandalorian?
Yeah.
He's freaking fantastic. And he was the one who insisted that they used the puppet. They were going to go full CGI all the time with Baby Yoda. And he's like, don't be a pussy. Use the fucking puppet. You built it. Use it. And he like shamed them into it. And of course, that's what makes the show is the puppet. So for many reasons, but that's like what's so special about it. So Herzog, it's incredible that even if people don't know, there's the Werner influence is actually like Baby Yoda. Is that Herzog is a big part of that in a crazy way.
You know, it's funny. I was, who does this anymore, flicking through the channels probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and you mentioned Incident Loch Ness, and I'm a huge fan of lake monsters and that whole lore and mythology.
Yeah.
And I started watching it halfway through. I didn't even know what it was. I had no idea. I thought it was a Herzog documentary. And when that Loch Ness monster comes out of the water, I like for 3 or 4 seconds was like, I can't, what? They got that on film, and then I realized it was just a movie. But I actually thought it was a Herzog legit documentary because he's such a good actor in that element. Who are some of your other influences as filmmakers, Mark?
Rainer Werner Fassbinder, Jim Wenders, Polanski, Cassavetes, Dreyer, Bergman, Antonioni, René. Fellini, Godard, Rivette, it just goes on and on and on. But yeah, I'm mostly, and of course, Wells. I would say Bergman and Wells and Herzog definitely that I go deep into for sure.
It's interesting that none of them are horror movie directors when you spent so much time working on Coven and now Coven 2. So were the horror directors still on your radar or just the movies themselves is what attracted you to horror?
First of all, I got to say this as a preparatory establishing this is that, you know, when we talk about something like Coven 2 or that, well, you know, none of this stuff happens like without people like Tim Hansen and Lila Wilson, who's one of the greatest music supervisors. So it's not just me doing this stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. It's thanks to those guys that this my world turns. And as when now coming back to this about horror films, and I only see horror as math. I don't like to be scared. I don't get into it. I just see it as a particular math challenge. I mean, I'm doing the more the scarier six. And I cringe when if I say horror, it's more like an intellectual abstract film with the horror element to it. But with kind of like, why are these people talking about it? Why is this language digressive? It doesn't add a compelling component to the narrative. What's with this? Well, again, it's a experimental abstract film in potentially the horror genre.
Yeah, well, there's some of those movies that fall into this space, Chris. Like if you watch Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, it's not a horror movie, but it turns very disturbing. And horrific and upsetting. And so there's another film called Dogtooth that Yorgos Lanthimos, who did The Favorite, did in 2009. That's like a very kind of, it's almost like Lars von Trier's The Idiots. These are movies that they challenge you and they make you uncomfortable and they have disturbing imagery and it's like an indelible marker that goes in your mind and leaves you with something like deeply unsettling. So yeah, I love those movies too. Hacksaw and Benjamin Christensen's Witchcraft Through the Ages is one of my favorites. And Mark, tell me about, I just got your movie, The Dundee Project, which I'm excited to watch.
Oh, thank you.
I just ordered that online. Can you tell us a little bit about that, if people haven't heard of it?
Sure. This is the deal, is that, as you'll see in the extra special features, that I don't get into small talk. Actually, they pimp that over and over again for entertaining effect. I was like, what? But those are great guys. The Dundee Project is produced by the found footage guys, and they're just fabulous. And it's thanks to them that you got to order that. And here's the deal, that every year in Wisconsin, and this is the past, same, it was the present, that they had a UFO gathering in July, and I would go because I was like, oh, wow, this is like in my neighborhood, so to speak. And the reason why the film, I didn't set out to do a film about it. I just said, well, I'm not going to sit around with these guys talking about general BS. I can't take it. I want to be productive. I bring the guitar. I bring my camera. And I'd film. And I'd film year after year without any noble, encompassing intentions whatsoever. I was like, damn, man, this stuff looks good at sunset. And, you know, and then found footage guy says, hey, man, you know, make a film after all these years. I said, all right. And that's how that came about. But, yeah, it was about interviewing these eccentric people. It was, you know, people were getting drunk, you know, looking at the sky, and it was just very wondrous. And I actually, had I got around to it, was going to make a feature film of it. And I said, hey, you know, we'll do this as a short. And that's how it came about. But again, it wasn't without any grant. It didn't set out with any grand design. It was just, this is what I do. This is my penmanship. I'm the author of this footage once a year, and ultimately we put it together.
That's really cool. I didn't realize that was how it came about.
I've made so many different films in a sense along those lines that could be put together, because I don't care. I like being in the moment. I don't sit around, you know, like I'm doing this and I'm doing that, because I'm already doing it. And then every once in a while, it comes together.
Do you know who else does that? Is Al Pacino. He makes these movies that he almost doesn't release.
Looking for Richard.
Looking for Richard, he released. And Wild Salome, he released. This documentary about Oscar Wilde. But he has like seven others that he just makes and funds and shoots and edits. It's like between movies, his therapy, kind of what he can control, what his passion is making these documentaries. And the Wild Salome one is incredible. Mark, can I ask you about theater? Because I see like often on your Twitter posts, you have doing theater. Like, are you doing a lot of, because I remember when the documentary came out, we actually contacted you and I got your radio plays, like Night School. Like I have cassette tapes of you and I love them.
Hey, how did you get a cassette tape of that? I need a cassette tape of that.
I'm going to find it. My brother like wrote to you or Mike or someone and got a copy of it. And you were like, here you go. It's like Night School. Like, I swear to God, I'm going to find it for you.
Yeah. Because that's kind of weird, man. Cause we were doing this on all kinds of formats. I did Night Run, Night School, and The Creeps. Those are professional and produced. And it was draft after draft of the scripts, casting theater actors, had Patrick Nettesheim, who did the music for those radio dramas, was the composer who does the music for Coven and is doing the music for Coven too.
Amazing.
So yeah,
I love the same
music composer.
I can vouch for that, Eli, because you sent me a copy of that. Because Eli and I have been friends since about 2005 or so. I remember driving down the road in between wrestling gigs, listening to Night School.
But Mark, it was like a way of having, because I just thought like I was so interested in your creative output that I loved. It was like a movie that you could take with you. And I would actually like, yeah, you're driving or you'd like lower the lights and gather around. Like that was because it was such a fun thing that we used to do as kids. And that those old kind of radio plays. I was curious what kind of pleasure, if you make a distinction or what you're kind of working on creatively in terms of theater or in terms of those radio plays or films, if you go from one to the other or all at once and really how you like it.
Sure. First of all, when I write something, it isn't just like some extemporaneous John. It's like it there's several drafts. You have to put it together. Carl King, who's one of the just one of these great, great aesthetic kings out there. I've done a radio drama for him, and I've also written one for myself called Room 18, which is done. Patrick's doing the music for it. And as for theater, I did a bunch of plays, and actually three of the three shorts actually got taken into festivals and produced 1 year here at the Village Playhouse in Milwaukee. I got it out in Los Angeles. They accepted it out at Samuel French, and then back in another play here in Milwaukee. Three for three that I submitted got produced in these festivals, and I've got others in that. So, yeah, I mean, I've got like all three of us. There's just a lot to do.
It's amazing. And so can people, are your plays, the ones that have been published, where can people read them or find them?
Well, we're weirdly enough, actually, the Excuse Me magazine chapbook published What's in the Box, which kind of makes its way around, like when they do fundraisers, like for the radio or that or whatever, they have that done. So actually, of all things, Excuse Me magazine, like I said, it's in chapbook form, published one of them, What's in the Box. And as for the other ones, yeah, we'll figure out on getting them out there as well. So.
Let me ask you guys this. It's something that Eli brought up a few days ago, speaking of all these films and you know, how much content we watch and this sort of thing. What do you think the future of movie watching is going to be? Because, Mark, you say that you pretty much stay in your house and don't really go out to the movies. I know Eli and I are...
No. That's, dude, hold on. Let me make that correction, Chris.
Okay, sure.
I live in Milwaukee, so we've got like three art houses right by each other in the same vicinity. I go see 60mm prints, 35mm prints all the time at the art houses.
Okay.
So that's not some dude. I'm one of the least people that stays inside, which might seem like the most vastest contradiction you've ever heard, but deal with the reality of the paradox.
Well, that makes sense, though, is that deal with the reality of the paradox. I love it. We're all theater goers. And I remember when I was a kid, when the VHS and Betamax first came out, I remember saying to my dad, like, do you think people still go to the theaters? And he said, yes, of course, they'll still go because people like the night out. They like getting out of the house. Now, in light of what's been going on, when the world returns to whatever the new normal is, do you think people will return to the theaters? Do you think there'll be more viewing at home and streaming? What's your thoughts on that, Eli?
I mean, my hope, obviously, is that people have had enough of being in their house and they want a fun night out. But, you know, you do worry when the first time you go to the theater, everyone's going to be worried what happens when that person behind you coughs or sneezes. I think it's like, is everyone going to go, all right, forget this? You know, I think if everybody feels like there is a way to beat this and there's either a cure or a way to mitigate it, whether, you know, whatever kind of medications they're finding work, I think it's really going to take that for people to look. What do I know? I don't know. I'm not an expert in any way, shape or form. But, you know, there's a real concern now in Hollywood that, okay, let's say the movie theaters reopen. Will the crowds, will the appetite still be there? The hope is that it is. And I think that, you know, we've been taught to socially isolate, stay away from each other, be afraid of each other. It's really terrible because you miss the joy of being with a crowd. It's like an incredible, beautiful, wonderful, unique experience. And I think once people have a great night out at the movies, it can remind them of how fun that is.
It's interesting, too, because like you mentioned, I could see there being some great fear in Hollywood because there's some giant movies that are being pushed back. I'm thinking of The Jungle Cruise, the new rock movie. Not only is it getting pushed back a few months, it's getting pushed back for an entire year.
Yeah.
What's the reason behind that?
I mean, here's the thing. If you have a movie like Ghostbusters, and part of your marketing plan of Ghostbusters is, you know, a sports event or some of these movies, I'm just saying, like, they're going to use the NBA and advertise at the games. Like, they do integrations. So when a movie comes out, you look at if it's baseball, basketball, football, they pay money to integrate with the games and to advertise on TV. If those things aren't happening, how are you going to see it? Also, you've got to commit, you know, these movies, they're spending $60, $80 million in marketing, talking about television spots, billboards, huge events, and you need months to plan that out. that if you're not, you can't spend that mm-hmm. money. Like Mulan spends the money and now they're sort of stuck. A Quiet Place 2 spends the money and then you build up this momentum and then you have to stop. What they don't want to do is blow out their marketing budget. And then they go, sorry, guys, we're not ready to go back yet. So that's the fear right now. So they're just pushing it for a year. It's a crazy time, right? No one's ever seen anything like this. I don't know, Mark, what's the feeling in Milwaukee, Mark? I mean, I'm obviously in a bubble here in Hollywood. I'm curious if there's a different vibe or what your kids say or what people are saying. What's the general feeling?
I think that a more helpful reaction would be this, is that the things that don't get spoken out loud and that are held by the quiet half, and there's actually a number of people that are, you know, everyone wants to be in health. No one wants to get sick and they want the businesses to survive and all of that. But there are a number of people who are completely fine with not socializing, no culture. And I mean, happy, organized, normal, quote unquote, people who are like, wow, this, whether if culture comes out, I could care less. And I could care less either way. It means nothing to me. And a lot of people unspoken are just saying, wow, this is a break. This can stay this way. And so that's more helpful than just regurgitating popular sentiment. So I'm just letting you know that's what's being unspoken, being spoken unspoken.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. I mean, I'm not trying to have false optimism, but I think what I've seen in Los Angeles.
Oh, no. Eli, everything's coming back. Next summer, you won't even know this happened. Businesses will be thriving. Everything will be, it'll be good to go. You know, not maybe this summer, but next, it'll be back to business. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but like I said, there's millions of us who are like most calm and most relaxed there'll ever be in their life because they're getting the break they were looking for.
What were you going to say, Eli, about Los Angeles and Hollywood, the attitude out there?
You know, right now, no one can plan movies, but everyone's kind of saying, so, like, there are auditions that are coming up for projects like, oh, yeah, we're shooting in June. You know,
right.
You're probably not. But I think that people need to believe that they are. So, and they want to be ready just in case. So everyone, I think, is developing and just getting stuff kind of locked and loaded, you know, hopefully so we can get back to. You know, filming in the fall, but it's like every other business. Everyone is worried, you know, the restaurants, this, there's so much that we have to go before we get there that it's, people feel weird even talking about it.
When you look back in the 80s, everybody in every movie's smoking. Like, look, just watch, you mentioned Ghostbusters, watch the original, it's smoking. That's something that you see it now and it's so foreign. I wonder if the art of shaking hands will now kind of go by the wayside, to where we're watching movies like Predator when Arnold and Carl Weathers like grab their hands and get that big handshake. If people be like, ooh, shaking hands, that's so strange. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost, I'm wondering if that's going to be something that gets left behind because of this.
I mean, are festivals going to come back? Are all that stuff? It's going to be weird. We're in some strange sci-fi experiment. There's a pretty cool Swedish movie from 2019 that I would say check out if you haven't seen it, called Aniara. Aniara. And it was made, it's one of these, I think it was made for low budget, but doesn't look good. It's kind of like a dark version of the show Avenue 5, but it's about these people that are on kind of a space flight. That's like a 3-week thing. And it's like a city, the ship, it just takes 3 weeks to get to the planet and it goes off course. And it's like what happens 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. It's based on a poem and it's really, really, really interesting. Watching what happens to people in isolation kind of made me think about it during this time.
Well, even just watching Cabin Fever, Eli, I told you that I watched it with my teenage daughters the other day. And by the way, the line James DelBello goes, I was jerking off with my dog stuck his tongue up my butthole. I was like, yeah, not in front of your 13-year-old twin daughters. Thanks
a lot
for that
one. By the way,
that
was improvised. I did not write that. James DeBella. James DeBella gets full credit. For that one.
But there's the one scene there where the cat, I can't remember what the blonde guy's name is, where he sticks the handkerchief over his mouth and he just walks away through the forest. Like, that's a lot of people that you see nowadays. If you get too close to someone in a grocery store, they're putting their handkerchief over their face and kind of wandering away. So you kind of had a little bit of a prophetic time in that movie as well.
It's sort of strange that Cabin Fever and also the Death Wish remake have been the two most, you know, the relevant, the ones that are, people are thinking about. Death Wish, I saw, is back on like the Fandango top 10 of rentals now.
Really?
The remake, yeah. Because everyone's thinking about guns and
yeah,
you see it here. There's the tension and the weirdness when you go out. If someone coughs in a public place, everyone freaks out. People aren't going out. They're trying to get everything delivered. I don't know, Mark, how is it in Wisconsin? Are people
the exact opposite? The exact opposite. They're flooding into the store. I'm thinking, wow, there's a serious virus. They're in the stores, you know, chopping this, that. It's like, oh man, this is crazy. But yeah, so I mean, it's different here in Milwaukee. I mean, people are, you know, like I said, they're all out exercising safely, but there's thousands of them choosing to go into the stores. And so, yeah, that's something to stay away from for sure.
But you probably know everyone in town where you are. I mean, that's like, you're like the hometown filmmaker. So it must be strange, you know, where everyone can see each other, but not get near each other now.
No, I mean, again, like I say, this is, there's people out on the street. So, yeah. I mean, you know, if they want to stop and talk or do whatever. But I think, and also on a different sense, there is a contingency of people that are definitely respecting and adhering to the parameters of safe conduct for sure. And there are those that are not. So it's kind of like a 50-50 thing here. So there's no sense of isolation. I mean, I'm looking at people right now, actually. So, I mean, they're out there.
Mark, do you film in your house at all? Or do you like just writing? And when you shoot, it's because you're shooting. Or do you ever just grab a camera and start shooting around just to have it?
Oh, it's so beautiful here because in front of me is a complete landscape of trees. I have just beautiful footage of snow and trees and autumnal colors. So, I mean, my studio, I'm looking at it right now. I can go out there and film, and we film out there. All I got to do is cross the street. That's it. And then with the Mortis Carrier 6, I'm just right down the street here in Shorewood. We're filming in before all of this, filming in the office and all of that stuff. So I can just walk.
How far into Mortis Carrier 6?
Everything's here in Milwaukee.
Wow,
yeah, Mortis Carrier 6. You heard it right, Eli.
How far into the process are you on that one?
Pretty far. Actually, I got all my, because I play the psychologist in it. So I got a lot of, I did myself in, man, because I write all these convoluted lines, man. And yeah, so I put the other actors through the paces, you know, through some serious shooting days. I got Corey Bulva, Caroline Miller, and Dannon Wright starring in it, and Barson Manashian. And, you know, they're just doing a great job. And so, you know, now my turn coming up, but now the virus hit, so I got more time to memorize these lines. But yeah, we're pretty deep into shooting it. We filmed some, most of the major scenes with the great chunks of dialogue, yes.
Oh, so you got hit right in the middle of the shoot, though. That's
yes,
tough.
Sir.
That's tough.
Yeah, but again, that leaves time for additional planning and so forth, so it's not like time's going to be squandered or something like that.
Well, Blade Runner, the Writers Guild strike hit, and they were suddenly down for 8 months, and they just painted sets. That's why Blade Runner looks like Blade Runner.
Last couple of questions, Mark. I just had watched something where I went down the YouTube rabbit hole of, you're talking about Milwaukee and filming around the town. When you were, and you did quite a few appearances on the David Letterman show, but there's a kind of a really cool little kind of a travelogue you did for Milwaukee. Did you seem like you got along pretty well with Letterman? He seemed to take a real liking to you.
Yeah, no, I never got it. That stuff to me, that's not even part of me. All of that stuff is like a put on, and I don't even recognize his existence. Because what the thing of it is that people, you have to be responsible to your formative instincts. And there's a lot of people probably in sports and in bands and so on and so forth that very gigantic lives, and some of them, not all of them, oh man, I betrayed myself. You know, I really should have learned this in school. I really should have done that. I should have really did this, that, the other thing, or did these push-ups, or learned history. And toward the end, man, it starts getting to them. And a lot of people like, oh man, so the things that you bring up, that those don't even exist. What really does exist is, like I said, you know, I could physically cry if there's betrayal today, and I am mapping out the rest of the day and facing the things that need to be done. And that's the most important. Those are the things that count and that are thought about for sure.
You know, Chris, I have a similar reaction when I watch any old TV appearances I did around the Cabin Fever and Hostel time. Like I'm having fun and it's me in my early 30s selling a movie, but it just feels like I'm watching a version of a different person ago. And I now think like Mark, where all of that just started to really become a distraction more than anything. It wasn't making me a better filmmaker. It wasn't helping me focus on writing. So I just, you know, everything is about just living in the moment and pushing yourself. And look, Mark, I see it on your Twitter when you're like, it's the beginning of a week. Let's start. Let's see what we can do. Let's see what we can come up with. And, you know, I keep thinking, look, obviously it's a very stressful time. It's a very tough time. But if you're a writer, you know, Shakespeare came up with King Lear. He wrote King Lear during the bubonic plague. So like, if you can really, you know, if you can do that.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, there's a perfect time to be creative.
Yeah, what's amazing is actually I am doing a radio drama of King Lear. You know, I read I've been reading Shakespeare for years, and I had decided to do King Lear, and then I knew right off the bat musically it would be in, you know, C major, A minor, and so on and so forth. And so immediately the tone of the music was already set. And now I'm just, you know, in the process of, within a half hour form, obviously, it's King Lear, is what are some of the essential elements and what are you bringing that's a new voice, a new style, and a dynamic to it. So, yeah. And I just want to get back on another stuff that you mentioned. Yeah, I don't even look at that stuff. If somebody mentions it, I just ignore it. If somebody sends something, which they usually don't, I just immediately delete it. So I'm never even really even aware of any of that stuff. So it's like you're talking about something and then she's like, oh man, you're talking about somebody else, not me. But yeah, anyway, you know, Shakespeare, that's great in the fall, in the summer, and yeah,
very cool. I mean, Mark,
that's, yeah,
I love that. I can't wait to hear that. I really enjoyed the radio plays and the radio stuff that you do. It's really, it's just like I feel like you're this kind of endless fountain of creativity, and it just comes out. There's a radio play, there's a stage play, there's a written piece, there's a film. It's like you just, and you know, just reading as much, ingesting it, putting it all through your filter of the world. I think it's very, very cool. And I just want you to know that I find it inspiring.
Oh, and likewise, man.
Thanks, man.
Well, dudes, it's been a pleasure to talk to you guys, and I'm glad we finally got a chance to have a conversation after all these years of being mutual fans of each other's work. Mark, do you ever go to the West Coast at all? Ever hit LA?
Well, dude, that's what I said. I was just out there, man. I'm back, you know, doing other people's projects, you know, because I do a number of films and so on and so forth. So yeah, I mean, I go out there. I always bring Mario Van Peebles' Sweetback's Badass.
Yeah.
Song, the book on the making of the film, on that's my flight book, you know, until I finish it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And or not Mario, Melvin.
Melvin Van Peebles.
And yeah. And then two, I gotta say this, because you always come on, oh, you know, these projects. Well, like doing Colvin too. So we do like these limited runs of t-shirts. And can I tell people where they can potentially get these?
Absolutely.
Shirts, make this
for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Come true. So if you're interested in Colvin 2 t-shirts, go to colvinfilm.square.site, and we just do a limited run. So it's not like, oh my God, it's there's only so many, and you can get on the waiting list or whatever. It's colvinfilm.square.site, Colvin 2 t-shirts. And then that helps the cause, that continues to make the dream come true. And that does not preclude the Morty Scarier 6, because that's coming out this year too.
Lots of projects, man. Well, next time you're in LA, the three of us should get together. And
yeah, we'll bring in Ty West too. Be awesome. Next time we're all out here, we got to do this in person.
Yeah, that will be done.
Have a pumpkin beer somewhere.
Cold pumpkin beers for all.
Cold pumpkin beers for all. Well, guys, stay safe and stay healthy. And thank you so much for a great conversation today.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Chris. Thank you. And thank you, Mark, man. And stay safe and keep creating. It's really great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Cheers, guys.
All right, guys. See ya.